I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact.
To Maine now, where state legislators have overwhelmingly passed a new measure requiring food producers to label all genetically modified foods.
Now, a Hawaiian island has passed a law banning companies which produce genetically modified food from operating on its territory.
And the Vermont Senate is pushing the envelope where genetically modified food is concerned. It passed a bill on Wednesday that would make it the first U.S. state to enact mandatory labeling of foods made with genetically modified organisms known as GMOs.
And it would make more than 60 countries either ban or require labeling on GMO foods. The U.S. is not one of them. But frustrated citizens are taking a local approach to the issue, pushing for state or county regulations. Today, we bring you a special episode of Making Contact, investigating corporate control of our democracy and our dinner plates. This program is part of What the Fork, a collaboration between Making Contact, Center for Media and Democracy, The Progressive Magazine, and Food Democracy Now! To open up our show, producers Barbara Bernstein and Elaine Velasquez take us to a mom-and-pop farm in Oregon where GMOs, pesticides, and the growing consumer taste for organic foods are meeting head-on in the fields.
We consider ourselves in the Willamette Valley as conventional grass seed growers, and we produce 50 to 60% of the grass seed that's consumed in the world.
Harry Stalford and Willow Coberly own Stalford Seed Farms in Tangent, Oregon, the largest grass seed farm in Oregon's Willamette Valley.
I was shopping at the co-op and eating organic food. I realized that none of the grains or beans in our local co-op came from anywhere in the area. And then I started feeling guilty about not growing any of our own food. And I said, well, I think we can do that on our farm.
We're not going to switch over to organic farming, especially organic farming. My gosh, you know, I have to live in this community.
When I first presented the idea of farming organically to my husband, he said it was not going to happen in this valley, that there was too much weed pressure, and basically it was not going to work. So he allowed me to start our experiment on 11 acres of a 10,000 acre farm.
I thought organic production is just for a very selective few people who have a tremendous amount of money in the bank that they don't have to account for. I dug my heels in pretty hard. I just don't see how you can raise any type of crop without pesticides. We just let them take a few acres and try to convert it to organic. They'll learn for themselves what it's like farming without pesticides. And it worked. It kind of surprised me.
We spent years trying to convert to organic. And we would try to get a field to organic, and my husband would see weeds popping up and he'd go out and spray it. Every family that I know of in our area has been touched by cancer in one way or another. I actually asked him, I sat him down right after he sprayed a field, and I said, you know, our son is 8 years old now. Could you look him in the eye and tell him that you had done everything you could to keep him from getting cancer? And at that point, he stopped spraying the field that I asked him to stop spraying.
When we first came on board with planting organic food crops on a field south of us here, I would try to avoid the coffee shops as much as I could because I just couldn't take it. It was just a constant harassment. Well, what do they have you doing now? What do those women have you doing now out there?
In the past 6 years, we've gone from these horrible, weedy, unpredictable fields to some absolutely beautiful production that has virtually no weeds in it. And Harry's very proud to drive past them rather than hanging his head in shame and covering his eyes when he went past the fields.
Stalford Seed Farms now has over 500 acres in organic production, and a growing number of clients eager for their locally grown organic grains. But just as they are beginning to succeed as an organic farm, farmers in the Willamette Valley are getting pressure from biotech and big ag corporations to grow GMO crops.
I think the Willamette Valley has been pretty isolated from the rest of the United States, that we have not been on anybody's radar screen. And I just think that it's, there's one area that we haven't touched. Let's go see if we can get in there.
I know there's only two places left in the United States that can grow brassicas as a seed crop, and the Willamette Valley is one of them. You grow GMO canola in the valley, and all the brassicas, Brussels sprout, broccoli, cabbage, any of that family that are being grown are now going to be cross-pollinated with canola.
We need to go back to some of our basics and learn how to be farmers again and stop depending on pesticides to solve all of our problems for us. I just think you forget how to be a farmer and you forget how to do crop rotations and you think, well, I gotta have more analytical data in front of me. No, you need to walk your farm.
That was an excerpt from the upcoming documentary film Gaining Ground, produced by Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein. And for those of us who don't fully understand the connection between GMOs and pesticides, we have some help. I went to the offices of the Pesticide Action Network and spoke to senior scientist Marcia Ishii-Eiteman.
GE crops have been designed to contain or to be used with pesticides. And so even industry's own data indicate that virtually 100%, 99.99% of GE crops seeds on the market today have been designed either to contain an insecticide or to be used with an herbicide that the producer manufactures as well. So that is really the dirty little secret, if you will, of GE seeds, that they are the mechanism to sell pesticides. You know, around the 70s and 80s, gradually all the devastating environmental impacts of a lot of the pesticides that were out on the market were becoming known, and we were passing laws to protect the environment and protect kids' health and so on from these pesticides. So about in the 90s, Monsanto and the other major international pesticide companies began packaging their pesticides with seeds. Then they figured out through the process of genetic engineering, the plants had been designed to actually carry this toxin that when insects consume it, basically it kind of explodes their gut after they eat it for a while. So it's an insecticide. The more dangerous are the herbicide resistant crops. And so these are genetically engineered seeds that are designed to withstand applications of Roundup and therefore enable the farmer to plant the seed and then just spray the heck out of their field with Roundup because their plant will no longer die. But it's a great, you know, it's like the greatest marketing mechanism.
So it sounds like they don't have to lobby for better pesticide laws. They just have to lobby for seed, for laws friendly to their seeds, and the pesticides kind of get a free ride. And that, I guess that's where the myth of we're feeding the world comes in.
What the companies have done is they go out and they buy the best conventional non-genetically engineered seed varieties. They insert their genetic traits and then they patent it. So it becomes a Monsanto seed product. But the problem is now it's captured by Monsanto and is packaged and sold as a Monsanto product with all these additional patents on it.
So over this, it sounds like maybe a 3-4 decade story you're telling, where were the points at which important regulations could have been made?
The terms for the USDA, our Department of Ag, to decide whether or not to approve a genetically engineered seed was very narrowly defined as being whether it's a plant pest risk. And so they almost invariably pretty much find that, no, the seed itself isn't really going to pose a plant pest risk. It's not going to harm, you know, the plant next to it. Pretty much makes it a joke of the whole regulatory process. The problem, though, is we're going backwards in time because the new set of seeds that are about to be approved, these seeds have been designed to be used with 2,4-D. That is a neurotoxin. It's known to cause reproductive harm. So it's a very, very dangerous chemical. And when Dow first presented this seed, the seeds that are designed to actually be used with 2,4-D, there is such an outcry from the public health community. There's a letter sent by over 70 doctors and other health professionals to USDA and to the Environmental Protection Agency saying, hold on, this is insane. This is the wrong direction to be going.
Pan just got involved in a lawsuit in Hawaii. What's going on right now in Hawaii to do with pesticides, genetically engineered crops?
Biggest pesticide companies, some of the very biggest ones, Monsanto, Dow, Syngenta, BASF, they all use Hawaii as a testing grounds for the genetically engineered seeds that they are developing to market in the Midwest or in other parts of the world. So what happens there is that because they are testing the seeds they are developing, they are continuously applying massive amounts of pesticides, which drift out of the fields over into people's homes, into schools, into playgrounds. And for such a long time, those communities have been really bearing the brunt of all this pesticide exposure. So communities have said enough is enough.
That was the Pesticide Action Network's Marcia Ishii-Eideman. Now Making Contact's Laura Flynn has more on how Hawaii has not only become the testing ground for the seed industry, but a battleground between biotech companies and concerned residents.
Hawaii's year-round growing season and consistent weather create an ideal setting for farming. For many years, monoculture crops such as sugar and pineapple dominated Hawaii's agricultural landscape. Today, though, seed crops represent the largest agriculture sector, generating $243 million in revenue in 2011.
The majority of that research, especially in the corn seed industry, is done right here in Hawaii. The nation and the world have a lot to thank Hawaii agriculture for in terms of providing that background and that technology for use by other farmers.
That's Barry Bushu, Vice President of the American Farm Bureau, speaking in a video published by Monsanto Hawaii. Since the 1960s, biotech companies have maintained farms throughout the Hawaiian Islands, testing genetically engineered seeds. But with that technology also comes heavy pesticide spraying.
By the way, what you guys spraying? I assume you guys spraying chemicals, so where does it go?
Clayton Kubo lives in Kauai near biotech company DuPont Pioneer. He says he's been trying for years to find out from the company what they've been spraying.
Each manager as I talked to through the years was pushing that, oh, well, we cannot disclose. It's against company policy.
And Kubo's not the only one concerned. In July of 2013, Kauai's County Council heard hours of public testimony from residents regarding a bill requiring large farms and agriculture companies to disclose pesticide usage and locations of their genetically engineered crops.
My name is Gary Hooser, and I serve on the Kauai County Council.
Four biotech companies, Syngenta, DuPont Pioneer, Dow AgroSciences, and BASF, have seed research facilities and crops on the island. Hooser introduced Bill 2491 after trying to find out what the companies were spraying.
I made a formal request to the Department of Agriculture, and when I got the information on a portion of the pesticides, it's even more alarming. You know, there was 22 different kinds, they're really bad things, they're banned in other countries.
And I came to say congratulations to Kauai. You guys are the leaders.
The bill passed in November 2013 with the Kauai County Council overriding a mayoral veto. And the battle over GMOs isn't limited to Kauai. Hawaii Island has banned new genetically engineered crops from being grown on the Big Island. In Maui, organizers put an initiative on the November 2014 ballot to ban GMOs until the industry conducts an environmental impact study. In the state's last legislative session, over 30 GMO and pesticide-related bills were introduced.
We probably have about 2 inches, 2.5 inches worth of testimony.
That's for a statewide GMO labeling bill.
Dino Kimoto, president of Hawaii Farm Bureau Federation. So we also believe that the state shouldn't be doing any kind of local food labeling. It will, one, confuse the consumers.
Winnie He, private citizen. The Farm Bureau doesn't want to label GE, but they don't allow the farmers selling at their markets to say theirs are non-GMO. You know, what is Dean Okimoto and other lobbyists trying to hide?
But the biotech industry is fighting back tooth and nail. State Senator Clarence Nishihara, the Agriculture Committee chairman, has received over $13,000 in campaign contributions from biotech companies and lobbyists since 2006. In January, he introduced an amendment to Hawaii's Right to Farm Act. If passed, it would have shut down all the local initiatives pushing for GMO and pesticide regulations across the state. In Maui, Monsanto employees even held a rally.
We are here to provide information about the safety of our products and practices.
Syngenta, along with Pioneer and AgriGenetics, filed a lawsuit against Kauai County to prevent the new regulations from taking effect. Among other accusations, the seed companies claim the new law violates their state and federal constitutional rights. At a recent gathering of attorney generals, Hawaii's David Lui warned other states about the growing push for tougher regulations.
In Hawaii, there's 75% of the people want some kind of labeling. This is a national movement that is occurring, and don't think that it's not coming to you.
The National Conference of State Legislatures lists almost four dozen GMO and pesticide-related bills pending in 15 different states. The intensifying battle in Hawaii could be a sign of things to come. For Making Contact, I'm Laura Flynn.
You're listening to Making Contact, and this episode is a collaborative media effort investigating corporate control of our democracy and our dinner plates, bringing together progressive.org, alecexposed.org, and fooddemocracynow.org. For more stories and articles, go to wtfcorporations.com. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
In Southern Oregon's Rogue Valley, it's all about the seeds. A fan and a couple of Rubbermaid tubs are all that farmer Don Tipping needs to sort his own corn seeds.
So we want the bigger seeds are going to be the densest ones. They're going to fall heavy. Hear all those ones?
Tipping's been farming for the past 19 years, but this is the first time he's hosting a five-day-long seed academy at his Seven Seeds Farms.
And in case you're in doubt of what you're doing, just take this one and pour that into your hands.
The handful of students here range from young farmers to wannabe gardeners. Tipping, a bit of a seed evangelist, wants to reach them all.
Who's part of a healthy seed system? Is it all just farmers? Is it gardeners? Is it chefs? Is it people that shop at the farmer's market? Is it everyone who eats? You know, so we need to have all these voices as part of a dialogue.
In May 2014, Rogue River Valley locals joined that dialogue in a much deeper way. Voters in Josephine and Jackson counties considered ballot initiatives banning GMO crops. Farmers like Tipping worry about GMO pollen blowing into their fields, leaving them unable to sell their products as GMO-free.
The reality is there's this huge, you know, $40 billion organic industry now, of which a smaller percentage is seed. And when people buy organic seed, they know it doesn't have GMOs in it.
The Rogue Valley is a major player in that organic seed industry. But in 2012, they realized they were under threat. The revelation first came to farmer Chris Hardy, who was about to lease property in the town of Ashland. The owner told him the neighboring lot was leased by the Swiss company Syngenta, who was growing genetically modified sugar beets.
And I was like, genetically modified sugar beets? Okay. And then I realized we had been saving seeds for a number of years on our farm up the road, probably about a quarter of a mile away. And we were saving seeds on Swiss chard. Swiss chard's the same family as the beet family. It's all Beta vulgaris.
The problem is, the narrow Rogue Valley is very windy. The U.S. Department of Agriculture recommends 4 miles between farms to ensure that Beta vulgaris pollen, like chard and kale, doesn't blow into others' fields and cross-contaminate. If GMO pollen blows into your field, your next crop might very well not be GMO-free, and you can't sell it as such. This season, Hardy's growing squash, tomatoes, and peppers, but can't plant his own seeds at this site because of Syngenta's nearby fields.
Do you see these poplar trees sticking up right here? Right on the back side of those, about an eighth of a mile away, is a Syngenta GM sugar beet plot. And then as we look off 180 degrees off to the other direction here, that's another genetically engineered sugar beet plot. So we are surrounded virtually 360 degrees by pollen. We are upwind, we are downwind, we are all over the place.
Hardy, Tipping, and other area farmers got together to create a map of where they would grow crops each year, so no one's pollen would affect the others. But Syngenta, which has more than 36 plots throughout the valley, wouldn't participate. The company also didn't respond to requests to comment for this story. But they did spend $75,000 to try and defeat the grassroots ballot initiative banning GMO crops.
Hi, is this Susan?
It's 2 days before the May 2014 election, and the Our Family Farms Coalition office is packed with volunteers making calls to get out the vote across Jackson County. This campaign to ban GMO crops was outspent 3-1 by the opposition. Syngenta was joined by Monsanto and other biotech companies in donating more than $500,000 to try and defeat the measure. The No campaign, who refused numerous requests to comment, ran ads opposing the seed ban all over TV and radio, claiming it would be costly and an infringement on private property rights.
The Farm Bureau says it would be a disaster. Frivolous lawsuits bankrupting local farmers, new government inspectors accessing private property, and common fruits and vegetables made illegal.
But driving around Jackson County, most of the signs on the side of the road urge a yes vote. And on Election Day, voters dropping off their ballots at the Ashland Public Library cited a range of reasons they wanted genetically modified crops banned.
I want to protect our food supply, and it just hasn't been tested, further enough.
Because I support local farmers having more autonomy and control over their operations.
I just don't think that the chemical companies should come in and buy our local elections.
An Italian restaurant in downtown Medford is the scene of the action here on election night as the Vote Yes, Protect Family Farms campaign awaits results. Expected to come in shortly after 8 p.m., any minute we'll know whether Jackson County farms will soon be GMO-free.
Okay, they're counting. They have 39% of the ballots counted. 39% of ballots counted. Right now, it sits at 66% yes, 30%.
It seems to be official that we are so far ahead that there is no way that they can catch up. So we have officially won.
Campaign leader Elise Higley, whose own farm sits down the road from a GMO beet farm owned by Syngenta.
So this is the story of family farmers that fought for their right to protect their seeds and grow crops without fear of contamination from genetically engineered pollen. We fought the most powerful and influential chemical companies in the world, and we won.
You know, we've never had this kind of a victory. There's been counties where they've banned GMO, in California, but they never had people actually growing it in that area. This is the big difference.
Veteran civil rights organizer Magdaleno Rose Avila says Latinos, many of them farm workers, voted to ban GMO crops because of the health impacts of the pesticides they bring along with them.
If we're going to win, we need everybody. And that's what this community has done. It's taken the farmers, it's taken the business people, it's taken the students, people of color, and it's talked to everybody.
A similar ban also passed that night in neighboring Josephine County, although for legal reasons, it may not stand up in court. Next up for Oregon is a statewide ballot initiative to label all GMO foods. Organizers are collecting signatures for November. One reason that vote in Jackson County was so contentious was that it may be the last time Oregonians are able to decide what they think of genetic engineering. That's because in 2013, the state legislature passed a law preventing local cities and counties from making local laws regarding agricultural practices. Joining me now by Skype to talk about the politics and the massive amount of money behind what's being called preemptive legislation is journalist Rebecca Wills, who wrote an article for the Progressive magazine about how the Oregon state law came to pass. Rebecca, welcome to Making Contact.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
So what are the roots of Senate Bill 863 in Oregon?
So Senate Bill 863, which was a bill in the special session, actually had its roots in an earlier bill that was introduced in February, but it did not pass. But then later on in the year, it surprised everyone when it came back in a very big way. All of a sudden, there was even more special interest power and special interest money on display. I spoke to Representative Pete Buckley, who represents the Jackson County area, And he said there were a lot of things about the bill that really surprised him.
Once the signatures were gathered in Jackson County and it looked like there was a proposed ban going forward, all of a sudden there was tremendous activity in Salem. The Oregon Farm Bureau, the organization called Oregonians for Food and Shelter, which basically is a lobbying group for the larger agricultural interests, put into the legislative process the idea of doing a statewide preemption on any regulation of GMOs on a local level.
The idea of preemption is one that a lot of different industries and corporations have been interested in lately. At its heart, it is an override of the democratic process. So what the bill did, not exactly for Jackson County, because Representative Buckley managed to get an exemption in there, but for any other counties that would like to ban GMOs in their area, was it prevented them from having a say in what happens in their agriculture and the food that goes on their plates.
And you also work for a project called ALEC Exposed. ALEC is the American Legislative Exchange Council, and some of our listeners know them, but for those who don't, who are they and how and why are they involved in GMO policy in Oregon?
ALEC is a group that calls itself a membership organization for state legislators, but what in practice it actually is a membership group for big corporate interests. What the corporate lobbyists do who join ALEC for a lot more money than the legislators pay in when they join is they meet with these legislators in these meetings behind closed doors, and they vote alongside the legislators on what they call model bills that change the law in states around the country. Those bills range from the Stand Your Ground Law, which was originally a Florida bill drafted by the NRA, which ALEC helped pass in different states around the country, to voter rights legislation, voter ID legislation. And most recently, last year at its annual meeting, the task force that covers food and farming approved a bill that overrides exactly the kind of GMO ban that we saw proposed in Jackson County. The chair of the Agriculture Subcommittee of the Energy, Environment, and Agriculture Task Force at ALEC is a representative of CropLife, which is a trade association for the pesticide and GMO corporations. And the co-chair was a legislator from Oregon named Representative Sal Esquivel.
Rebecca, my understanding is that there's a similar preemption strategy taking place on the national level, an effort to have Congress pass a bill to prevent any states from passing their own GMO regulations.
Right. The Grocery Manufacturers Association, which is a national trade association of the pesticide and GMO companies, as well as a lot of more grocery-oriented corporations, has introduced a bill that would override states' efforts to label GMOs. Several states, including Connecticut and Maine, have already passed bills that would allow them to label GMOs, but only when enough states in the area, in the Northeast in this case, have also passed bills. Vermont, on the other hand, just passed a bill, it was signed, that labels GMOs and does not have the contiguous states clause. So in response to laws like Vermont's, the pesticide and GMO industry has very little other choice than to introduce national preemption legislation.
Rebecca Wills writes for The Progressive magazine. You'll find a link to her article on our website, radioproject.org. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. This program has been made possible in part by a generous grant from the Vocal Fund. For more on corporate control of our democracy and our dinner plates, check out WTFCorporations.com. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. And check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.